Commencement, the Beginning of a New Era in Higher Education by Kate Colbert and Joe Sallustio with contributions by Elvin Freites is now available for pre-order on Amazon. Get your Kindle edition or your softbound book. It's going to be
amazing.
Fierce Education targets higher education leaders, administrators, and faculty, and those driving technology adoption decisions in this new blended learning world. Go to www.fierceeducation.com for all the latest news, tips, and successful case studies of what higher education institutions are doing to better student engagement, ensure equal access, and improve the assessment process. That's www.fierceeducation.com.
Welcome back, everybody. It is your time to Ed Up on the Ed Up Experience podcast, where we make education your business. This is not Dr. Joe Sallustio. This is Elvin Freites. And it's been so long since I've hosted an episode that I am super rusty, but that's okay, because that's what we do here at the Ed Up Experience. Today is a very special day for us. We are recording episode number 500. Yes, number 500, which is absolutely insane. We started on January 20th. Actually, January 25th, 2020 was our first episode. And I can still remember me hiding in my closet because my kids were home. It was during COVID time, and trying to be in the quietest place as I could on our cell phones. We were on our cell phones and we were having great discussions, and we have just continued to grow and haven't stopped since then. It's been fantastic. And so thank you all so much, all the Ed Uppers, for your support, for being with us through this 2.5 years. And now to our 500th episode, we will continue on. Obviously, we have our president series, which we have 176 college and university presidents, which we have two today. One is former, which is great. My co-host is great. Former guest, former host, because he actually was the host when we did an episode. And now he's my co-host. So I'm going to bring him in now. I don't have any sound effects because Joe's not here. So I'm just going to have a regular old playing fun episode with our voices and no sound effects. So I'm going to bring him in. His name is Tom Bailey, and he is the president of Teachers College at Columbia University. Hi, Tom. How you doing?
All right, Elvin. How are you? I've got to say, you didn't say this, but I've got to say this, that Elvin is one of our alumni.
Ah, yes.
So it is wonderful that you have accomplished so much. We're so proud of you, and we hope we've been able to contribute something to the success that you've had. So I'm really delighted to be here. I am I'm a president, but of course I spent many years studying community colleges. I gave advice to presidents for a long time, and it's a little bit different actually being one and thinking about advice I might give. But anyway, I think that such an important sector faces a lot of challenges, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Tom. And yes, I am a very proud alum of Teachers College, so thanks for mentioning that. I appreciate that. Totally changed my life. There are two episodes that you can listen in and me talking about that. If you want to go back, go to edupexperience.com and check out all the episodes. So we have an amazing, fantastic guest today. We are honored to have Dr. Russell Laurie Hart, who is the president of Amarillo College. That's how I pronounce it, by the way, Amarillo College. How do you pronounce it?
We say Amarillo.
Love it. Well, thank you so much for being here on our 500th episode. So we really appreciate you taking the time to spend with us. So let's get into it. Let's have some fun. So the first question is we want to know is, tell us all about Amarillo College. How do you do it? What do you do and how do you do it?
Well, first of all, congratulations on 500 episodes. It says a lot about your ability to connect and to identify and to share. So congrats. I'm glad to be a part of this momentous honor for you all. And glad to share the Amarillo College story with you. And I'll just give you the brief rundown and you can direct our conversations as you so desire. We're a community college in the Panhandle of Texas. We have about 10,000 students. We're a community that has more refugees per capita than any city in the country. And we're a community that has voted historically as the most conservative congressional district in the country. As a community college, we are committed to one thing, and that is loving our students to success. And that means knowing who she is and advocating directly for her and rebuilding ourselves for her. And we've done that with a theory of change that focuses on three things: removing a life barrier in an accelerated learning environment, and a deep culture of caring. If we do those things, then Maria, our typical student, will complete her degree or certificate and transfer or go directly into the workforce. So removing a life barrier really focuses on social services, emergency aid. We've hired social workers. We've trained every employee in poverty. Accelerated learning is migrating most of our classes to 8-week formats, integrating required tutoring in almost all of our classes, and completely eliminating developmental education and going 100% to a co-rec model. And then a deep culture of caring, that third piece of our theory of change, is really acknowledging who our students are and changing ourselves to meet the needs that she brings to us. So our students wrote the values for the college that are written into every job description, that are the basis of our evaluations, and are the things that we talk about all the time. And they're non-traditional values because they really focus on really good help, service, and love. And I think because of those, that theory of change and this culture of caring that empowers every employee to know that students are the number one item on our job description, is how we've moved our completion rates measured by Texas from 19% to over 60%. And our goal is to be at 80%.
Wow, that is absolutely phenomenal. Fantastic. Congratulations on that. And thank you for all that information. So before I pass it on to Tom, I do want to kind of zoom in on something you mentioned, which I mean, mind blown. The students wrote in the values of each position. So can you kind of walk me through that? How did that happen? Was this before your time? And how does that
actually work? It was one of the scariest things that I've done as a new president and a first time president is I knew that our data was terrible and that we were not responsive to students. And we'd fallen into the trap that I see a lot in higher education where students get in the way of our jobs. They aren't the reason for our jobs. And so I use secret shoppers to just understand the student experience, and especially in the first, in the beginning, the onboarding process. And I showed the data to our students and I asked them to tell me why our students weren't being successful at the levels we needed them to be, both in classroom learning and in retention and completion. And what they said changed who I am as a person, not just as a professional, because the top 10 things they told me that were keeping students from being successful in the classroom had nothing to do with the classroom. Childcare, healthcare, utility payments, transportation, food, housing, legal services, because we penalize poverty in this country. And so I knew we had to rebuild our college for a student that we didn't even know. To do that, I ask our students to tell me what the perfect college looked and felt like to them. And just through a series of three meetings with exercises, zeroed in on companies and institutions, both locally and nationally, that were known for really good customer service and a responsive culture, and a relational culture. And we put all of those values on a wall, and through a series of selections, narrowed them down to five values that are now written into our job descriptions and the basis of our hiring processes. And they are not higher ed values. I often joke as a recovering faculty member that I choked when I told our faculty that our values were going to be wow, innovation, family, fun, and yes. But when they understood what those words meant in practice and understood that the students selected them, it's been a transformative part of building a responsive culture.
Wow. Over to you, Tom.
All right. Well, it's great to be talking to you. I've heard a lot about you. And I have to say that, you know, you mentioned the, I think the notion of loving your students to success is, you know, that's gotten around. And I've actually heard about that from other sources. But, you know, one of the things that you've emphasized here is that is addressing some of the basic needs of your students. And so, you know, I think we all realize that, and we certainly have this in New York, where students, you know, don't have a home to live. We had students who are living on the Staten Island Ferry. You know, they don't know where they'll spend the night. They don't know where their next meals will come from. So say something about the actual practical things that you've been able to do to address those issues.
Well, I want to affirm how important they are and how pervasive they are, and not just in community colleges, but universities across the country. And we worked with the Hope Center at Temple to the Hope Center's developed a national survey to measure food and housing insecurity. And what we initially learned is that 50% of our 10,000 students were housing insecure and 47% were food insecure. And we understood that we weren't playing in the margins anymore. And that when you look at the national statistics, we're in line with what is normal for community colleges. And universities nationally have a 34% food insecurity rate and a 40% housing insecurity rate. These aren't a handful of students that as bleeding hearts we need to care for. They, in some cases, are the majority of our students, and we are blind to their lived experience. So the way we responded at Amarillo College, every employee understands the different kinds of poverty, what it teaches students about themselves and us, and that our primary response to it is relationships that can help connect students to resources. The misnomer and the stereotype is that if you're living in the war zone of poverty, you know where all the resources are, how to access them, and are probably gaming the system and getting rich off assistance. And the reality is just the complete opposite. And because the majority of those students that are housing or food insecure are working one or two or three part-time jobs while living in that war zone of poverty, they don't think that those services that are available, even if they knew them, would apply to them. So we've done two things. We hired social workers. We trained everyone to understand poverty, and we hired social workers and put them in our advocacy and resource center. And in our early alert systems that are integrated into our grade books, when faculty are inputting homework or test grades and they have a student that's struggling, they can pick that they need academic interventions with tutoring, or they can pick after talking with a student that they need social services intervention. Once we're made aware from faculty, our social workers will reach out and case manage that student. And when we do case manage those students, we have emergency aid that we've made available to them that they will get within 24 hours, no questions asked. We're not asking them to perform their poverty for us or to prove it. If they tell us that they need help with a transmission, getting a transmission fix, we're connecting them with a list of mechanics that will either fix it for them at a reduced rate or fix it and we'll pay the mechanic to fix it. If the student comes back a second and third time, it typically means there's something deeper going on than just an emergency. And so we start trying to connect them to deeper resources beyond that emergency. And the ugly part of this entire conversation is that our communities, our country are drowning in resources to help that go unused and untapped every year because people don't know how to access them, or accessing them is so difficult in a time frame that they don't have. And so that's what our social workers do. They'll connect with emergency aid to meet an immediate crisis and then try to connect them to the resources that can keep those crises from happening again.
So you know, those are, really important things to be doing. But of course, another issue with community college students is, you know, they take so long to finish.
Yeah.
If they finish, so if there's, you know, if finishing will give them a degree, which will give them, you know, more financial security. But of course, if they're bumping along for years and years, so I know that one of the things that you've done has been tried to speed that up, try to sort of use a guided pathways model to make sure that students aren't wasting credits, wasting their time, getting lost. So perhaps you could tell us a bit about the guided pathways work that you've been doing.
So our guided pathways is the foundation of that second element of our theory of change, creating an accelerated learning environment. When we started this reformation, over 80% of our students were part-time, and now we're about 50-50 full and part-time. Getting students on a path that is clear from the first day and not having to come back and determine what's next. There's flexibility to change the path, but it's clear we're putting them in classes for the 2 or 3 years that they're going to be with us. They know what those classes are, and we know what their classes are going to be so that we can have them appropriately scheduled and staffed. That's been the most powerful part of pathways is helping us get rid of classes that are adding time to degree, that don't help in transfer, and giving real clarity on what classes students need to take. And in a lot of cases, friends, just narrowing their options. If they want to be in a pathway, instead of giving them 72 classes to pick from, they may have 7. That's been really important. But the other part of that pathway acceleration that warrants a lot of discussion is that we changed our structure from a semester to an 8-week format. And the reason that was important is the majority of our students were taking 12 hours a year when we needed them to take 12 to 15 hours a semester. And because the majority of our students are first gen and they're working 2 part-time jobs and raising 1.2 kids, and living in the war zone of poverty, we had to build structures that were responsive to them and put schedules in place that were responsive to their needs, rather than forcing them to adapt to when we wanted to teach or what we wanted to teach. So for example, Maria is still just taking 2 classes at a time, but she's taking 2 classes in the first fall 1 and then 2 classes in fall 2. So she's only focusing on 2 classes at a time, which is really important for her. But over the course of a semester, she's taking a full load rather than a part-time load, which gets her access to more scholarships, more aid, which makes it more likely for her to finish. And she can see the finish line from the very beginning rather than wallowing in a 5 to 6 year process.
Yeah, and when at the CUNY College Research Center, we actually looked at Texas and looked at the number of credits that a typical student who finished an associate's degree, of course, most don't. And I forget what that was. It was 90 instead of 60, something like that. So that that's really a serious problem when you, especially if we go back to the, the issues of poverty, and whatever it is, resources are needed to take these courses, which ultimately don't count.
So it's the resource of time that doesn't get accounted for on the same level of importance as the financial cost. But When we started our Reformation, we had, I think, on average, students were graduating or transferring with us with like 102 hours for a 60-hour degree. We've reduced that to 68 hours now on average with a pathways model, with a clarity of it, with a clear advising model of those pathways, and with trying to help students early on identify career interest, and then with each subsequent term, get more clarity on where that interest might end up. And my own two kids are prime examples. My son just graduated from Amarillo College. My daughter just finished her first year at AC. And neither one of them knew what they wanted to be when they started. They just had a general interest of social sciences, or for my daughter, performance or music. After a year of taking classes and assessments, she's clear that she wants to be an opera singer. That's another podcast episode. And my son is transferring to Georgia to be the University of Georgia to be a history major. He knew he liked learning and writing and reading. He didn't know what, but through that pathway of social sciences, was able to narrow down to a major that gave him clarity on what his next steps were. We want that for every one of our students, not just students that share my last name.
Fierce Education is the place where higher education leaders, administrators, and faculty, and those driving technology adoption decisions in education can access proven methods and best practices as they rethink pedagogy and business models in the new blended learning world. Through its website, www.fierceeducation.com, virtual events, and newsletters, Fierce Education focuses on rethinking higher education in a blended learning world. Fierce Education's key tenets are to use technology for teaching better and reaching learners everywhere, addressing business model changes required to move forward, and workforce preparation for adult learners who are out to reskill. That's www.fierceeducation.com.
So, you know, I think it's interesting because when you think about it from a student arriving at a community college, it's really an extremely complex institution with many majors, many courses. And of course, there's not lots of resources for advising. So yeah. I think that, you know, narrowing down their choices, I mean, it's, I must say, as you know, it's gratifying because, you know, we at Community College Research Center worked a lot on guided pathways, and it's always great to see it being implemented and having a good effect on it. So, but one, there's one thing which we always emphasized, and I think have increasingly emphasized, is that if you're thinking about a pathway in a community college, you can't limit it to the pathway in the college itself.
Right.
So that pathway needs to extend from the high school, and it needs to extend into the four-year college. So tell us a bit about the kind of things you're doing to elongate that pathway so that it really takes them from where they need to go to their ultimate end.
It's such a great point. Our pathways work actually starts with freshmen in high school, really eighth graders in our local ISDs, where we start talking about what pathway options are, and we start exposing them to options as early as their first year in high school. And then when they're juniors, start advising them specifically to a pathway. So for a typical student, Maria, if she comes to Amarillo College, if she says she's going to come to Amarillo College as a junior in high school, and she has a clear idea of what she wants to study, that she may want to study, be an engineer, then we're starting to advise her as a entering junior in high school to the university engineering degree that she thinks she might want to go into. So for our region in Amarillo, we have Amarillo ISD, Amarillo College, and then West Texas A&M University, where the majority of our students transfer. When our students come in that want to transfer to university to get a transfer degree, we're advising them to the WT degree plan, not to an Amarillo College degree plan. From the very beginning, if they're wanting to transfer, we're trying to align them even at junior and high schools, to the university degree plan so that every course leads to the prerequisites that they have to get to the major courses so that no hour is wasted. It has required a lot of trust building, a lot of doubling down on the why it needs to happen, because I can sit with my superintendent and president colleagues and we can talk about pathways and we can all agree to it. But until the counselor and the teacher and the community college advisor and the university advisors can all understand what we're trying to accomplish and trust each other to advocate for this joint pathway, then you're spinning your wheels. And I think we're starting to see the power of what happens when trust and collegiality and collaboration are the foundation of building those pathways out for students. It eliminates confusion, not just for the student, but their family. And I talk all the time, students don't care about organizational structures or which budget is paying for which position. They just want someone to help them. And we have to take responsibility for our students, both what's happening with them before they get to us and then what's happening to them once they leave us. And Pathways has given us the framework for that.
So I've always emphasized this, that it says something about our education system that we take the institutions with the students who face the most challenges and give them the least resources.
Yeah.
So how is it that obviously there needs to be more counseling, more advising and other things. So how have you been able to do all of these things within the constrained resources that you have?
It's a really, maybe the most important question, and one with a really complex answer.
And to add on to that, while you're thinking, Russell, because I'm fascinated by this, how are you able to get buy-in from everyone? Because I keep hearing innovation, I keep hearing change. What's your magic? How did you do it? So have fun with these questions.
Well, I think answering your question and answering Tom's question has the same answer.
Good.
Our reformation was started by a fiscal crisis. The state cut us $4 million and we were only expecting to be cut like $100,000.
Oh, wow.
At the last minute on the last day of the session. And I had a newly elected board of regents and I was a first time president, not even finishing my first year in office. Wow. And our newly elected regents, when they saw this crisis, I think the typical way higher ed was respond is, well, we got to hike up tuition, we got to hike up taxes. And our regents were like, you've got to get this bureaucracy in order before we invest more money in it. And so we spent a 9 months in conversation with each other about where our opportunities were, where we were wasting resources, where we were failing our students. But what came out of that experience for me as a professional, and I think as our college, is that we understood clearly in that crisis moment, because we had to eliminate 12% of our employee base and 1,287 years of service left the college. Wow. In my first year as a president. And I'm telling you, I didn't take the presidency to be the hatchet guy. Yeah. That wasn't, I'm an academic. I talk about myself as a recovering faculty member. I had these grandiose notions of, you know, supporting the academy, and then a crisis helped me understand how perilous our reality was in higher education. I learned early on that our future could not be in the hands of a politician. Politicians were not going to come save us. We had to figure out how to innovate our way out of this crisis. So we just started looking at our own data that was foundational to both buy-in and leveraging our resources for impact, because in the beginning, I think we were, community colleges are continually under-resourced. And I also think community colleges are the most resourceful. Having spent the majority of my career in a university setting, I didn't understand the lack of resources till I got to community college. So we had to figure out really quickly how we leveraged the resources we had to have the biggest impact on student success, because our state said they were going to fund us on student success. And I knew that we had to build a case of transformation that would attract outside funding, either through philanthropy or grants. And so we used data summits to look at our data, and then we used innovation team challenges to identify new and innovative ways that we could leverage our resources to meet the needs that our data summits were exposing and that our student voices were explaining. That's how we built the culture of innovation, but it was born out of a financial crisis. Now our data summits are, we've matured enough that we can use our data to predict where we need to put our resources so that we can make them stretch even further. So an example would be very early on, we did pilots on with a part-time social worker. We did pilots on tutoring. We did pilots with advising. All three of those pilots' data points indicated impact on learning, on retention and completion, so we scaled them for impact. But we made the commitment at that point that if we couldn't scale an intervention for impact, we had to stop doing it. So there was as much stopping as there was creating, and taking the resources and things that we stopped doing and putting them into lowering the advisor to student ratio, which still is not anywhere near where it needs to be. Required integrated tutoring that's free to students, the social services impact, all of those things is where we pooled our resources to focus on what was going to change the direction of our college. But it meant we had to let go of things that historically were fun for us or we thought were critical, but they were only affecting 20 students when we needed them to affect 2,000. And so we had to redirect those resources to the interventions that were going to change Maria's life.
So that, I mean, I think that's a crucial point, which I think the kind of culture of reform in higher ed in general, but certainly in community colleges, was the targeted kind of, I don't know, I'm trying to think of another word besides boutique, but the reform that took 100 students and did something to them. So yes, that's the, and in a lot of ways, I think the research paradigm led to that, because those are easier things to measure, right? You know, you get your 100 students in this program and the 100 students who aren't, you can compare them. But of course that, you know, going from 100 students to your 2000 is a completely different issue. So in that sense, I mean, I want to emphasize something. You probably talked about most of the elements of this, but earlier you said that your completion rate, I forget what the numbers were, something spectacular. Yeah. So you know, tell us a little bit more about that. You know, how you've done that. What were the sort of characteristics of that? Because I think that's a story that needs to be told.
Well, it is all the things that we just talked about. It's giving Maria a pathway that's really clear, a pathway from beginning to end, not just from semester to semester. It is aligning all of our courses to those pathways and talking about, we call them communities, talking about communities in integrated with each other rather than celebrating 150 different majors. We're talking about 8 communities. So that's been a really important part of, but then structuring it where Maria can actually finish the classes she's starting. So all of that emergency aid and social services and the tutoring that is required to help Maria deepen her learning to stay in class are foundational. Really, those are social services, 8-week classes with integrated required tutoring, killing dev ed, and then building a culture that sees students as our primary job and removing any barrier that might be in our way. So our, you know, Texas measures can, and then I think the final thing is for Maria, especially first-gen students, is building stackable credentials that give her confidence that she can do the next step. So instead of for Maria going, oh, you want to be a mechanical engineer at university, there are some stackable credentials that affirm to her that she deserves to be here and that she's smart enough to be here. So like in our technical programs, there may be a level one or a level two certificate that have some job applications to them that lead to an associate's degree in that same field that leads to a job with a family sustaining wage. Each one of those steps, Texas measures as a completion point. So I talk about completion different than graduation, although our graduation rates have more than doubled. But it is building an intentional system that is streamlined to promote Maria's completion and removes all the bureaucratic bullshit that we would normally ignore that cause pain points for her that would cause her to drop out. And what Maria's kept telling us in our secret shoppers is that when they would face one of the pain points of not understanding a deadline or not understanding what a FERPA was or what a FAFSA was, that's our problem, not hers, but she was interpreting those things, meaning that she wasn't smart enough to be in school. And so we just had to eliminate the bureaucracy as much as we could and realign ourselves for her pathway rather than the ease of our work.
So I need you to emphasize, to speak a little bit more about something you kind of passed over, which was DevEd. So you know that, you know, DevEd was something that the majority of community college students went into and never came out of.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think pushing the kinds of reforms you're doing, co-rec, putting people earlier into college, there was a lot of opposition to that and criticism of that reform because these students just aren't ready. So how can you put them into a class? So tell us a bit about both, you know, how you did that and also, you know, following up on Elvin's question, you know, how you overcame people's opposition to that.
Really, really important part of our own transformation because we didn't start there. I think if I'd started with saying we're limiting dev ed, I'd have had a vote of no confidence. I'm not sure I was far away from that when I had to stand in front of people and say, we're eliminating 12% of our employee base. But we built buy-in through data. And we built buy-in by having the data reveal pain points and then allowing our employees to innovate solutions for it. So when we got to the moment where our data about dev ed was really damning. We had become a school that had gotten national attention for our dev ed instruction. Our dev ed completion rates had improved dramatically every year. We were getting more and more students out of dev ed and into a 4-credit class. Now it may take a year to do that, but students that started in dev ed were not complete and successfully completing dev ed were not completing at a higher rate as students that it wasn't affecting their completion. So we brought CCRC into the conversation. Davis Jenkins came and talked with our dev ed faculty and said, here's the data, and here are some options. And so I'm really proud of our college because at that point we had normalized looking at our data. We had normalized innovating in response. And when our dev ed faculty saw the data, it hurt their hearts because they felt like the work they had been doing dedicating their whole careers to might not have had the impact they wanted. But they said, we got to try it. And so we piloted it. And with an understanding at AC that when we pilot something and it works, then we have to scale it. And that first pilot with DevEd faculty that thought this was going to fail and that we were harming students in the process, but they were willing to try it. On the back end, when they saw the data, said, you know what, we don't have any choice. This is the right way to go. And the other part of that DevEd reform is I think where a lot of our DevEd faculty and faculty have gotten crossways just isn't in the language that students don't come to us prepared. I think we have to unpack that and understand that that lack of preparation may not be as severe as it's been communicated by tests that none of us really believe in, and that may not be culturally responsive to the students that we actually have. But a lot of the language around killing DevEd and moving to a co-reg model was about saving institutions finances more than it was around saving students financial aid so that they could actually get a bachelor's degree at some point. And we made a commitment that no DevEd faculty member would lose their job in the process of transitioning to co-rec. Now, it may shift, and it has, and I'm proud of the work that they've done in conjunction with their colleagues that are teaching in those introductory 4-credit classes. But in often cases, they're co-teaching that 4-credit class with their co-rec students sitting right in there with them, and it is working. And in many cases, our co-rec students are outperforming the students in the same class that didn't require additional support.
So, Tom, I know you want to ask more questions, Tom. We got to wrap up.
All right. Okay. I'm frustrated, but, you know, go ahead, Alvin. It's your show. So
maybe we'll do a part two, right? Maybe we'll do a part two. This is great. A fantastic conversation. Wonderful insights. And Russell, you've been so sincere and just so insightful. And we really appreciate your time. So last two questions for you, Russell. Tell us something that maybe we did not ask you, maybe Tom did not ask you, that you want to talk about Amarillo College, about the future, about what's going on, any projects, anything you want to announce on the EdUp experience. And the second question is, what do you see as the future of higher education?
Well, I'll answer the last question about what I see as the future of higher education by telling you what I think we're trying to do, what's next at Amarillo College. Because I think what we're trying to build ourselves for is in response to the directions that I think higher education is going to have to migrate to. And especially community colleges. I live in a rural community. We have hundreds of colleges and universities in rural settings. And we've acquiesced innovation and economic development to urban institutions and urban settings. And our rural communities are dying. And I think our institutions of higher education are going to have to become the epicenters of economic revitalization by becoming the epicenters of innovation and technology. And what the pandemic has shown us is that you can live in Amarillo and work for Google in San Francisco. You just have to have the skills. And we've not intentionally built those skills, thinking that, oh, we've got to build to the workforce that exists in Amarillo, which we do, but we've got to build to the workforce that our nation needs, knowing that Maria can live in Amarillo while she meets that high-tech need. Amarillo is going to reimagine itself through Amarillo College as a tech hub with tech skills that are going to be built in 2 and 3 and 8 weeks that will be stackable, that may have a credential tied to it, that may not be for credit at all, that will be skill-based and responsive and individualized. And I think the future of higher education, the institutions that can reimagine what can be and should be rather than spend time worrying about what was and worrying about how we protect our institutions. We're going to protect them into extinction. We have to protect our institutions by reimagining them and rebuilding them for a skill economy and a tech economy and a robotic and automation economy that is going to impact every major that we offer. And I see that innovation coming in a community college sector. And I think Amarillo College is going to be on the forefront of it.
So let me quote one of your values. Wow. Big wow. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much. I want to first thank my co-host today, Tom Bailey, president at Teachers College, Columbia University. Tom, thank you so much for co-hosting today.
So, Elvin, thank you for having me. It's been great. I really enjoyed this. Russell, it's good to get to know you. I'd heard a lot about you. I can see now why I've heard a lot about you. So, I mean, I think it's, you know, community colleges are in a tough spot with a huge, huge, you know, job to do, but with such resource constraints. And I mean, we didn't really get into political issues. Those are also challenging, I know.
Very.
So, you know, I really congratulate you on the progress that you've made. You know, I'm sure that other people around the country, I know you were an Aspen finalist. So that's certainly other people are recognizing that. And I think the lessons that we get from your experience will, you know, resonate around the country. So anyway, thank you as co-host. Thank you for taking the time to join us today. And, you know, I hope our paths cross.
I do too. I've enjoyed this conversation and appreciate the fact that it has been conversational and honored to be included in the 500th episode. And thank you all for highlighting higher education itself. It's maligned in so many ways. And I think conversations like this can give a better, fuller picture of the greatness that exists within our sector.
Excellent. Thank you. So ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. Russell Laurie Hart, president of Amarillo College. Ladies and gentlemen, you've just ed upped.
Fierce Education targets higher education leaders, administrators, and faculty, and those driving technology adoption decisions in this new blended learning world. Go to www.fierceeducation.com for all the latest news, tips, and successful case studies of what higher education institutions are doing to better student engagement, ensure equal access, and improve the assessment process. That's www.fierceeducation.com.